The Return of the Orange Virgin by Rob Hunter. Chapter 18, The Valiant Buffet. Harry Prophet Pease looked sideways into the mirror, hunting for a place to part his hair. Clippings from a do-it-yourself haircut clung to the sink's porcelain sides. He doused himself with lilac vegetal, then wrinkled his nose and tried not to breathe. That evening was an illustrated lecture, a slideshow, at the Valiant Trust Memorial Institute Free Library. Alma Nightingale was a known regular. What the hell? Why not? I've got her washer for her, haven't I? The slide presentation on the Holy Land was a grand old standby of the Valiant's biweekly offerings, usually wildlife and nature-oriented. Often, someone from the Audubon Society would give a talk on birdwatching. A park ranger from the Wildlife Preserve an illustrated nature walk. The spectacle of green foliage up there on the beaded screen in the reference room on an icy winter's evening with the nor'easters howling past in the Bay of Fundy made Alma Nightingale dream of donning her silk with a tropical flower print. Reverend Murtry from the Methodist Parsonage had actually been to the Holy Land, but had run out of film. He'd filled out his slideshow with stock shots available at the tourist kiosks. Grainy cliffs of Masada in rotogravure orange alternated with Coca-Cola transparencies of the Via Dolorosa, Bethlehem, and tract housing in the Golan Heights. Reverend Murtry had typed out his commentary. The lights were dimmed, and by the light of a lamp on the lectern he started a cassette player. He'd prepared a tape with music and automatic pulses to advance the slide carousels while he gave his full attention to the narrative. Percy Faith's rendition of music from the film Exodus good-naturedly did the best it could, a command performance from the land of useless tunes where it had slumbered fitfully through the decades, awaiting Reverend Murtry's call. A bright young couple from away was tied up in an intense conversation with Alma at the refreshments table. Coffee and cookies, the Valiant Friday buffet. More circumspect and less outspoken when sober, Harry caught a snippet of conversation while cruising the refreshments layout. Full of charming, picturesque, bearded people whom I never want to work on any major appliance at my house again. Jaws snapped shut as they caught sight of him. Aware of Alma's earlier acquaintance with Harry, they were inquiring as to any other jack-of-all-trades available locally. They were looking for a fixer, learned in the ways of automatic household washers and dryers. Harry vaguely remembered doing some work for them the previous summer. Even after 40 years, he was proprietary about Alma and moved right in. Harry's approach to the huddle of small talk generated a ripple effect. This was a problem of ventilation. The Valiant Trust Committee had argued, quite reasonably, that taking down the storm windows in the spring was only inviting trouble. A building, after all, was sort of like a bottle of wine. Unbuttoning one's edifice to let it breathe with the advent of the warm months, taking down the storm windows for other than routine maintenance, say every 5 years or so, was borrowing trouble. The summer gales caused weather damage to the exposed interior casements in the knockabout trip down the bulkhead hatch to the Valiant Memorial Trust basement snuggery. Some panes were inevitably broken, requiring replacement. The exterior double glazing, thus stored, acquired a layer of dust and needed washed before being put back in place for the winter, when it would be discovered that they'd shrunken in the dry of the cellar and had to be painted and caulked about the seams when rehung. Despairing of fresh air, early each spring, Mrs. Gladstone herself popped the storms from the clerestory windows at the opposing sides of her office space that welcomed borrowers and book returners as they climbed the three steps from the entryway. Enough fresh air for one librarian and the occasional browser. This was not enough for the Friday Enlightenments plus Harry. Harry's body sweat was cooking the emollient of his afternoon as he trod manfully toward the cookies and fruit punch in a vapor haze of sea dog beer, grass, and sweat. The pallid figures clustered about the paper-covered library table, stopped their talk, held gestures uncompleted. "Lo, Conan the Barbarian has come to wassail at the gates," thought Joyce Gladstone, librarian, suppressing a titter. Harry noticed the quiet of the usually chatty Friday night crowd and guessed it might be him. Were these, his friends and neighbors, sending him a not-so-subtle declaration that he did not belong here? They looked like the little figures architects put into their models, tiny, elongated people, interspersed with shrubberies and trees made from sponge dyed green, with painted shadows to suggest a sunny afternoon. Was he out of place? Harry was not a regular communicant at the Valiant Trust Sabbath Eve menu of uplift. He was getting the transparent treatment. Admittedly, bad timing for a raid on the goodies, but he was nursing a hangover and wanted to go home. He didn't feel like staying for the show. Besides, after the lectures, the buffet was so picked over it was hard to do it any heavy damage. Joyce Gladstone caught the whiff of Harry bearing down on her and charged right on with a cheerful determinedness, hoping to cut him out of possible intrusion by keeping the conversation bright, up, happy, and busy. She turned her back on the circle, and it tightened defensively, as if wolves prowled outside their campfire. "Doesn't Alma look pretty?" said Joyce. "You always had good chemistry, you and Alma, Harry. Don't put her off. She's going to ask you to fix her washing machine. Do it, Harry. For me. It's such a little thing to ask. I'm not comfortable with this stuff yet." She nodded at the tableau of the Valiant's Friday nighters. The familiar faces had a snapshot quality. They had been frozen in position. Reverend Mercury tinkering with his slide projector, Bobby Farrell waving his finger. They'd been having a sports conversation, Harry recalled, pressing home some fine point about basketball statistics with the Rev, while sneaking a peek down the front of Harriet Hopwood's dress. Mrs. Gladstone blinked and stared blankly from vacant, puzzled eyes. "Was I speaking?" she asked Harry. "Distinctly. I thought I heard myself talking." "Strange." She turned back to the circle. The stockaded wagons parted to welcome her. There was a splash as a ladle fell into the punch bowl. "Land sakes, can't take me anywhere," Alma's voice. Harry turned. She was dabbing at a stain on her silk print dress. There were small movements and the sounds of lungs being filled as respiration resumed. A tentative guffaw, most likely Bobby Farrell. Then random chatter broke out as the party restarted itself. A continuo of manly resonances, hesitant hushed chirpings, percussive shufflings, and rustlings, and the staccato cough of a smoker coming in from a quick toke, joined the counterpoint of Alma Nightingale's crystal glockenspiel, as with a susurrus of silk, she stirred the ice cubes in her tureen of pink citrus soup. Their unconcerned random chatter broke through Harry's haze. The group was realigning itself with the perplexing indeterminacy of small talk. Harry tried concentrating, but the ebb and flow of people in their huddles and clusters made him dizzy. He cut Alma Nightingale out from the herd and focused on her. Just how much had he had to drink today? Figure it out tomorrow. Count the empties. He made an effort to bring his eyes into focus. He tried walking and found he needed to maneuver by shifting his center of gravity, letting his feet follow, stiff-legged. The room was swimming, and to keep from falling over, he had to balance on a very fluid pivot dead center in the middle of his hips. Damn! He wasn't that drunk. Funny how the beer catches up with you all at once. Harry had reached that plateau where the accumulation of alcohol gets the body drunk but leaves the brain alone to try to sink buckets from the free-throw line of social ruin. He'd feel his balance start to go, and his lower body would shuffle forward, trying to keep centered under the wobbly load. Still dreaming about a girl from high school, Harry? Harry turned to see a pig hopping up on the window seat next to Alma, claiming a warm depression vacated by Mrs. Gladstone. Harry stared. The pig was a spotted china, with a tight brushy tip to her tail that hinted at purebred bloodlines. "You wouldn't have a cabbage left in your truck, would you?" the pig added. "Huh?" said Harry. Oh, yeah, you're sure. He shook his head to clear it, and the pig was no longer there. The Orange Virgin was scheming. The Fata Morgana, Orange Virgin, etc., etc., had discovered a minor petulance. She fought it off, but it persisted. She spoke to a cat that lolled in the sun at her feet. "We live on the bow wave of perceived time, Sir Puss. Time is a comforting figment, a subjective place humans have dreamed up to give superficial meaning to their paltry lives. Everything is all air. And a glorious moment it was. We can never live it at once. We're merely writing its catalogue as it unfolds. Merrily we roll along." Morgana and the cat were high atop a turreted tower to observe the progress of an excavation far below. One of the gardener's boys had gotten a bad bite transporting the swans to a corral on the river as they readied to drain the moat. The Orange Virgin entertained hopes that the swans might also attack her groundskeepers, Lamprey and Taws. Not human, and yet less than the gods, at their pick-and-shovel work. "The shovel, a useful instrument," remarked the Orange Virgin. "It asks little in the way of affection, has no moving parts, and runs on dried-out crusts, cheese rinds, and yesterday's ale. Some time had passed since her interview with L. the Sky Demon in the cellars of the Hotel Taft, and after the manner of time passed beyond recall, there remained an air of melancholy tempered with a vague unease. And speaking of useful instruments, I shall require much pocket change, eh, sweet puss? The Orange Virgin wore a checked flannel shirt and a culotte with hiking boots.
Ha-ha! Money! That is the answer.
Morgana's big gray tomcat gave a boar, bleep, bleep, rubbed affectionately against her ankles, then, seeing a gloriously fat horsefly buzzing, forgot the moment, and was after it in a pell-mell dash up Morgana's tresses and off the top of her head. Suspended over nothingness, high above a hard ending on the sun-caked mud floor of the moat 30 meters down, he gave with a meow, as if in farewell to a foolish, pampered life.
Not yet an end for you, my pretty. A panoply of moles, voles, moths, and milk-filled saucers lies yet ahead, sweet puss,
said the Fata Morgana as she snatched the cat from the air.
Remember this. Follow the money.
This is the end of Chapter 18. The Orange Version continues with Chapter 19. Follow the navigation links at www.110leg.com, click the Orange Version, and pick up with the tale from there. And thanks for listening.